Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Ken Clark, and I'm the Executive Director of the Poetry Center, and I'd like to welcome all of you here this evening. We have a very special guest, Maxine Chernoff and Paul Hoover, here, who will read. Before we get into the program, I want to remind you of our next event, which is November 1st, 6 p.m., same place, same time. It's Robert Creeley. If you're not a member of the Poetry Center, I encourage you to join. Individual membership provides a year of Poetry Center programming, and gives you the choice of a Lannan literary video from this catalog's back in the back table if you'd like to pick one of these up and select your video when you join as a Poetry Center member. Now this is the chance that I get to do my favorite thing, and that's to thank our sponsors. We are in residence at the School of the Art Institute, and they provide major support for us in kind. Major support also comes from the Lannan Foundation, the Fred and Susan Novy Family Foundation, the Chicago Department of Cultural Affairs. This program is partially supported by a grant from the Illinois Arts Council Estate Agency. Our new website at poetrycenter.org, one word, was designed and built by Jeffrey McKinsey, and he donated his time and talent to do that site. The Hyatt on Printers Row has provided in-kind support, as has the design department at the School of the Art Institute from all of our promotions. It is now my pleasure to introduce Mark Perlberg. He's a founding member of the Poetry Center, and he's the programming chair of the Poetry Center Board of Trustees. Mark recently published a book of poetry called The Impossible Toy Store, and I'm sure, Mark, if you corner him afterwards, we'll provide a way for you to get that book, if you so desire. We also have books at the back table back there by tonight's authors, and they will be signing, hopefully, after the event. Mark?
Thank you very much, Ken. Got to get a big thanks for talking about my book. So, good evening, and let me express my thanks for all of you coming tonight. It's a particularly happy evening for the Poetry Center, because it's a homecoming, actually. The center is honored to welcome back Maxine Chernoff and Paul Hoover, in part because they are among the founders of the Poetry Center. They were among the original group of poets who were called together by that late, brilliant, and sometimes zany Chicago poet, teacher, and editor, Paul Carroll, to found the center 26 years ago this month. We met in Paul's small apartment on Locust Street off LaSalle, and the rest is history. The center has become by far the longest-lived organization of its kind in the city. But we are chiefly honored to have Max and Paul, Paul and Max, here because they went on to establish exceptional careers. Let me just sketch briefly the outlines of Max's achievement, and then I'll be back up here to introduce Paul. And do same. Maxine Chernoff will read first. Chicago-born, Maxine is the author of 6 books of poems, 2 collections of short stories, and 3 novels. Her books of poems include New Faces of 1952, which won the Carl Sandburg Award in 1985, and a Penn Publisher Award. And Next Song is another one of these books, which appeared in 1998. Her first collection of short stories called Bop was reprinted in the Vintage Contemporary series, and that won 2 awards, including the 1986 Friends of America American Writers Fiction Award. Her second collection, Signs of Devotion, was a New York Times notable book for 1993. The most recent of her novels, A Boy in Winter, is as contemporary as the morning news. Set in Chicago, it tells of a young boy who accidentally kills his friend with a hunting bow, and how he and his mother work through the ramifications of their tragedy. And there are copies over there of that book and others by Max and Paul, as Ken Clark just mentioned. The Boy in Winter was published by Crown last year. Like her husband, Paul, Max has read her work in many locations in the U.S. and in Australia, Germany, Brazil, Belgium, among other places. Most of you probably know that she's professor of creative writing at San Francisco State University, and with Paul, edits New American Writing. Maxine?
It sounds so good, I should just stop, right? Is this the microphone? This is the microphone. This is the light, so I shouldn't talk into the light. Okay. If I talk into the light, it really won't help much. Because this is the Poetry Center, I thought I should read at least some poetry rather than all fiction. And because it was actually publicized that I'd be reading poetry also, I thought I'd better do that. So I'm going to read some very old poems first and then some newer ones, and then I'm going to read a short story, a pretty new story. Set in California. So I'm actually not going to read from A Boy in Winter, but you should all buy it anyway because I see a lot of copies of it back there. It's only in hardcover in the United States, but if you fly to Australia, you can get the paperback. That's the only place it's in paperback. I'm really happy to be back in Chicago and see so many friends in the audience. Chicago's a great place, and it's still my home place. And I'm thankful for it for many reasons, for my good friends and the family and my writing that all started here. And also it's where I met my husband 26 years ago tomorrow. So if he hadn't come to Chicago, that never would have happened. So I'm glad to be back here and be reading for the Poetry Center. I'm going to start with a poem in which my daughter appears as a 4-year-old, and now she's a 24-year-old. So this is one of the older works. It seems so new, though. I don't know. Maybe as you get older, everything seems new again. You forget you wrote it, and here it is again. So this is called Sotto Voce. Although she's only 4, my daughter knows Spanish. Say blanco, she demands. Say negro. Words are the finest toys, she tells me, with eyes that are arrows. My husband speaks with the virtuosity of a drummer. Suspiration, humidor, revivify. Beautiful words float upwards like jets sowing clouds. If my cat could only speak, it would be in a shrill nasal French. I wouldn't understand. Languages wash over me, scratched in cold telephone booths, tapped on window panes. I'm sorry to admit that I'm inventing yet another, in the dark, furtively as one remembers an obscene old kiss. Just as I'm thinking about it, my daughter shouts, Verde, Verde. She thinks so much depends upon it, palm trees, parsley, dollar bills, that I can't disappoint her. Foolish girl, I think, locking up my new language. Then Verde dissolves, naked and bloodless, into the busy air. So that poem is 20 years old. And when my daughter heard it once, she kicked me because I called her foolish girl in it. I seem to have written a lot when I look back on my early poetry about having children, and that's because I've been a writer as long as I've been a mother, basically. I had a first daughter 24 years ago. So this second poem as well is about children, but I wrote it before I had twins, even though it's about multiple births. It was written before I ever suspected I'd be the victim of that. And my daughter, too, again, helped me with this one because she had this children's book that if you're a parent, maybe you've seen, where there's triplets, identical, I guess, triplet girls who are all wearing the same black and white spotted dress. Familiar to anyone from the library? It was one of those black and white and red and yellow only books that probably was from the 50s or 60s. I don't remember its name, though. So this is called Identity Principle, and she gave me the first line of it. Triplets are so embarrassing. Too much soup in the soup of life. Who needs an alphabet with 3 O's, a tangled birth, a troika of woes? Picture the mother swelled as a cloud, the gallop of 3 heartbeats like a posse through her. Or twins those clever monkeys allowed to eat at table, identical birthmarks matching hairnets, the sound and the echo. And old age, one twin wheels the other before him, meeting himself after the stroke. So you decide, even among brothers and sisters raucous as wedding guests, to be an only child. the stance you take in making love, in walking crookedly, in robbing the sperm bank, until you have a child and people say, she looks just like you. In her face you see the same wish, to be an island so distant, she'll never see another pleasure boat. And yet another children and baby poem. After I had twins, I couldn't write very much because they were very busy people for many years. And every once in a while I'd get to like kind of scribble down a poem. And this is one of them, but I condensed them into one baby because I didn't want to write about multiple births. I just wanted to write about being a mother. But it's interesting because the cover of my book, Bop, has a baby on it. And when the boys were little, each of them thought it was him. You know, so if Philip said, is that me on the book? I'd say yes. And if Julian asked, I'd say yes. And, you know, it's like when your kids say, do you love me the most? And you say yes, right? So this is called How Lies Grow. The first time I lied to my baby, I told him that it was his face on the baby food jar. The second time I lied to my baby, I told him that he was the best baby in the world, that I hoped he'd never leave me. Of course I want him to leave me someday. I don't want him to become one of those fat shadows who live in their mother's houses watching game shows all day. The third time I lied to my baby, I said, isn't she nice? Of the woman who'd caressed him in his carriage. She was old and ugly and had a disease. The fourth time I lied to my baby, I told him the truth, I thought. I told him how he'd have to leave me someday or risk becoming a man in a bow tie who eats macaroni on Fridays. I told him it was for the best. But then I thought, I want him to live with me forever. Someday he'll leave me. Then what will I do? Right now they're both very eager to leave me because they're 15. And the last one from this book, which is a selected poems that came out a long time ago, now 1991, from another Chicago press, from Chicago, of course, is called Poised. And the other thing I noticed looking back on my poetry is how many poems you write about longing for spring when you live in Chicago. And this is one of my longing for spring poems called Poised. I think everything in it is clear. Raymond Burr was in a TV show called Ironsides that most of us are old enough to have remembered. And Corin in it is the name of our daughter, Paula, my daughter. So Poised. A stick of dogwood from a Georgia swamp is wrapped in yesterday's Korean Times, $1.99, while the florist rings up my sail, chanting, Easter coming, Easter coming. Corn asks, why Easter? She doesn't believe in it. Oh, sure, to the resurrection. Real miracles are ungainly as Raymond Burr and Ironsides overflowing his wheelchair, or rivers bulging in spring with dogs on top of garages and frantic music from the Orpheum movie theater. I reread Hemingway. He's crazier than I remembered, but his simple declarations are slow and reassuring. Quote, the town was very nice and our house was very fine, end of quote. A word for everything leaves the door ajar in the fact of being me, like cold red spring on Mars or walking on an ice-locked lake, slipping along like art, hesitation meant to hold a calm. So those are from my book, and then I'm going to read some newer poems. Newer poem means written in the last 10 years. That's what is new for me in poetry. This is called Claims for Lost Objects, and I think that I kind of stole the premise for this from Paul, who writes about impossible objects and unreal objects a lot. So Lost Objects, this is called Claims for Lost Objects. The slings and arrows, the bifurcations, the earnest reader, ripe for a crime. The clairvoyant uncovers an ideology of rapture. The plot turns on existence, an affinity for blue. Would I have told it to bring you grief? Would it sleep inside your patience like a little branch of misgiving? Restored to you this backlit saga. Restored to you this alphabet of clouds. And this is called Next Song, and this was the title of this little chapbook that one of my graduate students who started a press did in California. Next Song. Heard from the beginning as noise or the hum of a distant planet, rooms filled with waking from letters, seances in chiffon for a different century, no millennium, a calendar empty of time as a theory, time as an ache, and constancy looted its steamer trunk vacant of signs. Yet we reach for composure, ask a corny tenor to make the day not trivial but deep, as the color we once named then forgot, when our project was momentarily to please. And I think what I was thinking about is when you write fiction, maybe your project is more to please than when you write poetry. Maybe not. Maybe only I think that. This is called Action We Can and Can't See. And it begins with a quote from Benjamin Franklin. Men don't become very good or very bad in an instant. In an inland city, any autumn, a blameless life outside of weather. Names losing their limits, proof becoming a legendary absence. For to oppose theory to belief is to let words tell the story, surviving among fir trees and macadam, real or imagined, drifting as if to fill the doubled mirror, the truth in waking, each moment a temporary distance evaporated by history. The shadow in the copybook, a twinge of conscience, wintry as a swimmer in sunlit water, the owner of 10,000 dreams and their interpretations. The next one is called Beneath the Form. Since I've moved to California, I haven't become a Buddhist, but I seem to be writing about Buddhists a lot because they're all my neighbors are Buddhists. It's like Buddhist Avenue. They're all Jewish Buddhists, by the way. I think that's the only kind of Buddhist that lives in California. This is called Beneath the Form. A Zen student and a great blue heron, a Christmas wreath and her short blue dress, the dust of art, best name for a colorless liquid, the concept of God, hungry and receding, poet as laborer, the uses of stone on Saturdays when momentary release gives way to eternal dilemma, when Sam asks Daryl to pull over at the next translation, tainted author of your own sad birth, between breaths, you are your own witness, your own excavation. And I think I'll read two more poems, and then I'm going to read a story, even though it's the Poetry Center. It'll have to be the Story Center for 10 or 15 minutes. This one is in the manner of what people do now, where you take a text and kind of parse through it for a language that's interesting. And so this poem, which is called Todorov at Ellis Island, is me taking two books, Todorov, who's a narrative theorist, and a book about Ellis Island, where all our relatives came when we were not here yet, and kind of opposing the two stories, the story of Todorov, who looks at narrative for structural cues of what narrative means, and then an actual story from the Ellis Island book about a girl who was trying to get into Ellis Island. And now I've told the whole poem in the way that I always hate that writers do, and the story ends up being better than the poem, but oh well. Todorov at Ellis Island. The secret of narrative in the sight of the lovely original fixtures, the false accusations, the K for insanity. An indigent writer specifying the predicate, fear of fire and ramshackle buildings, the ghost of the fantastic looking across frozen water. He felt swallowed up by the 200 stairs, by a procedure based on external criteria, plot, and genre likely to become a public charge. While from the mountains of northern Italy, refused admittance, a girl acting mad, alluding to hermits and saints. For to destroy does not mean to ignore, does not mean to build the story machine, nor to feel the grass underfoot, but to turn, as if spoken to, into what we represent. And one more poem. This is called A Relief Map Glows. And it has Mapplethorpe in it for some reason. A relief map glows. Until personal identity, wise men, the use of metonymy and slavery become an encrypted engine touched by drama. From the captain's window, tributes to Mapplethorpe felt like the wedding day of speech and recitation. He'd been sent to find subjects, patterns of syntax, crystalline notes on yellowed paper, ancient accounts of typographical errors. The final movement pointed to politics, as in, I feel afraid, hold me, Ira. Of the possible uses of poetry and culture, he could name only three. Poverty, artifice, aging, secret graves of the many who could not speak, but were wakened nonetheless. Okay, so that's poetry. Now, maybe since there's like 500 copies of my book back there, I should just read a really quick chapter of my book so that it has something to do here. So I'm going to read just this tiny chapter of A Boy in Winter. A Boy in Winter is told by three people, told by the mother of the boy who committed the terrible accident, by the boy himself, and then by the father of the child who died. So I'm just going to read a little piece of the mother's narrative, which is in the opening chapters of the book, called Toys. Women are desperate in so many ways. Your Aunt Sheila and your life, rich with good female friends and art films and high-premium museum memberships and worthy political causes, deflates to a joke about celibacy. You're my mother, a frustrated businesswoman whose only real job was managing my father's death. You're Carol, hooked to fat Riley flowers, Riley of golf and green for St. Patrick's Day, and so little imagination that you congratulate him for remembering a dream. You're me, in bed with Frank, not uttering a protest, when he tells me he's taking Danny deer hunting for the weekend. Danny, who had a bite or tear pieces of toast into gun shapes, because I refused to buy him a toy weapon. Your gun has jelly on it, I'd say. And Danny would usually laugh. Danny, who fashions shivs from aluminum foil for his backyard games of pirate. What's wrong with you, Frank, I should have asked. What are you thinking? Why do boys need to learn this in a world where warfare is conducted by electronic mail between attorneys? Why not take him to divorce court if you want him to be a man? Frank, why does Danny need to learn to kill anything? But I was in bed with Frank when he first brought it up. Imagine a man and woman naked, a nipple sucked red, dried semen on the man's furry belly, all the exhaustion and camaraderie of good sex perfuming the air. I want to take your son for a weekend in the woods, the man says. He's just given the woman such great satisfaction that her body is still vibrating with it. If she could see her own face, she'd notice a warm blush washing the portrait of her surrender. A weekend in the woods, the woman says. But can't you just fish? It's too late in the season to fish. We'll hunt, the man smiles. Hunting, the drowsy woman thinks. And without a word, she turns her face away from the issue, toward the window where the afternoon sun, through the rice paper shade, is a game intruder. So that's just a tiny taste of A Boy in Winter, so that I'll support the effort back there. And I'm going to spend the rest of the reading with a story that I wrote in California, again, that starts with Buddhists, but it's really kind of based on an episode, unfortunately, in my son's life, where a very forward girl pursued him. And in what, in like sixth or seventh grade, when you didn't think children knew about these things yet. So it's called Coming Apart and Together, and of course it's, you know, like all fiction, it's not based on the writer's biography at all. All the Buddhists were getting divorced that spring. First her son's favorite teacher, then her cousin's cousin, and now her neighbor. Maybe that's why Diane hated California. It was a land of temporary commitment, future disappointment, human frailty. People's lives fell apart. Endings were too frequent. No wonder she kept hearing the word closure bandied about. That day on the news, a tough-looking police detective had announced, "We want closure on this episode, over an anonymous human corpse." Was everyone here philosophical, ministerial, even the cops? Or maybe it was the personal gray cloud that had hung over the family since it settled here. First there's the price of houses. Their new ranch home, made of wood and glass, had cost twice as much as their sturdy Cape Cod back home. As much, Diane liked to add, as an estate in Connecticut she'd seen advertised in the Sunday New York Times. Yet another problem. The local news seemed quaint. Often the front page contained the California version of scandals. Unleashed dogs at beaches. money missing from a Save the Redwoods fund? Did she miss the murder and mayhem of Chicago, the steadfast cold, the glaring sun? Maybe, as her children themselves lamented, she missed a simpler life. Her sons' childhoods had been prematurely shortened by the move. After a year of grade school, her twins were middle schoolers with teenage anxieties and tales to tell. Giselle, is it Giselle or Giselle? What do people say? Giselle, right? Giselle. Giselle said she'll kiss my penis in the bathroom, Jeremy reported one day after school. This news came shortly after Diane had come back from the mailbox where she'd encountered her neighbor weeping. What's wrong? She had whispered to the woman she barely knew. First he left. He was her partner, a word which made Diane think of her father's business associate, Chinless Larry. Their partnership had lasted 40 years. Mother lode, partnership, odd words for human ties. Had her neighbors been married or not? What did it matter when the tears were real? Still, it made Diane's brain work harder to process relationship information when no one was clearly attached, except the same-sex couples whom the mayor dutifully married each year on some day that maybe had a name. Couples Day? Partners Day? Her neighbor had been speaking to her all along. Occasionally, Diane had caught a word like stewardess or package or retreat. But this is too much. Too much, Diane questioned. Now my dog, too. Your dog left? A border collie carrying his own leash appeared to her. But leashes were also de rigueur. The dog would be holding a map of hiking trails in Marin, or nude beaches, or kill-free shelters. He died after the operation. Oh, no, Diane commiserated. It made her truly sad that dogs died, that children grew up, that husbands seemed happier elsewhere, too. And in a land which flowered so abundantly, where spring came on with the gusto of an Italian opera, and the growing season lasted 9 months, not to flourish seemed a sin. Failure to thrive, she pictured, as a sash on her chest. I'm sorry, Diane lamely offered, as her neighbor hurried back to her cottage with the mail. She'd been so impressed when she and Dan had been invited for a drink at the neighbor's elegantly simple, child-free, perfectly nestled cottage shortly after they'd moved in. How could their house have such a view, and her and Dan's none? Luck was a matter of inches in this place where the geography was unsteady as people's lives. As their roads curved endlessly, houses perched closer or further from the fronts of their property, affording some a view of trees and fence, and others a vista beyond. In Chicago, east had meant the lake, and everything else could be located from that fact. Which way did their house face now? Diane couldn't decide. Whatever their location on the planet, the penis issue, as they now called it, was a subject of commentary between her and Dan in bed that night. Imagine an 11-year-old girl saying that. Did you even know that was a possibility at 11? Dan asked, shaking his head wearily. So many commiserating nods, so little time. So many regrets they juggled in their bedtime conversations until sleep erased their uneasiness. No way, she added. Isn't it sexual harassment? Probably. What are you going to do about it? That was the other problem. Moral dilemmas were among Diane's duties. I'll call the school, she vowed into her pillow. The principal, a thick, serious woman who didn't seem indigenous to the state, wasn't available the first time Diane called. Did she harass you too? Diane asked Alex the next day. No, she doesn't like me, Alex said matter-of-factly. He was the child with glasses. Maybe perfect eyesight or contact lenses caused the trouble in life. Glasses kept a person more serious, a viewer of life's developments rather than a participant. It had cheered Diane to read that Orson Welles had been awkward and friendless in grade school. Her son with glasses was maybe a genius, the world would realize later. How do you know she doesn't like you? She knows me too, but she just asked Jeremy. What was Diane to say? Should she tell him that the girl who didn't like him secretly wanted to kiss his penis too to keep things even? Oh, she muttered. So many moments ended this way. Maybe O could replace the period or semicolon, she thought. When the principal called back several days later, Diane had been at the grocery. Dan was home editing the material that gave him a convenient and portable life. Her job offer and his portability had led them here. They'd given up friends and comfortable lives for moments like these. Your wife left a message about a problem your son's having with another child, Ms. Brockport stated. Well, it's more like the other child's giving my son a problem, Dan explained. Could you elaborate? The principal asked innocently enough. A girl is telling my son she'll kiss. Well, another child's offering my child sexual favors, Dan said shyly. That night in bed, Dan had made a joke about it. I wanted to tell her that this kid is offering Jeremy a Lewinsky. Both of them laughed nervously. Half the time it was a moral abomination, the other half a joke. Either way, it seemed to fit their new uneasiness. In Chicago, kids took lunch money, acted wild on the playground, or chased each other relentlessly. Suddenly, Diane recalled a girl there, too. Remember Sheila? She asked Dan. How many stores do we own? Jeremy had asked Diane one night during a phone call. Not any. Why? Sheila's asking. Sheila was famous for her ardent games of chase. She was an East Indian whose father owned a chain of donut stores. Tell her we don't own stores, honey. We don't have stores, Jeremy reported sadly, not making the connection between the information and the playground chase activity. Sheila, after all, was a tradition-bound suitor, her interest in Jeremy waned soon after the call. Maybe it wasn't California, but some change in their frontal lobes, Diane imagined, recalling the Sheila episode. As a group, they'd been generally happy, at least before California. Easy to please and amuse. You all laugh so easily, her neighbor once told her. Now the family subscribed to the discomfort channel. Every moment contained new anxieties and questions about their adjustment. Maybe they should have moved to Denmark, land of melancholy, Diane sometimes thought. You're so Rubens-esque, Diane whispered when he entered the kitchen that morning. Reuben sandwich, Alex asked. Maybe he was the unmelancholy one, the one not chased by girls. Maybe contact with the other sex brought on the melancholy. Maybe the only happy Californians were the newlyweds, with the hers and hers towels and the two big mama chairs in front of the TV. But no! A colleague at work had reported to Diane that a lesbian student of hers had been battered by her partner. Was Diane aware of any more problems of this nature among the students? Should the department hold a meeting about this problem? Why should Diane be aware of any problem? What was the probability of having such a problem? Was it greater to, lesser than, or equal to living in California for as long as humans have existed on Earth? None of her acquaintances were statisticians, so Diane would never get a reliable answer. Dan, she asked toward the end of the week, did the principal ever call? A few days ago. You never told me. I'm sorry. And you told her? Sure I did. Dan had gone tight-lipped on her. She'd have to wait until bedtime to receive more clues. Jeremy, did anything happen at school about Giselle? Jeremy had to stay in at lunch, dependable Alex explained. Why was that? Diane felt alarmed. We had to go to a mediator, Jeremy said calmly. Who's we? Me and Giselle. What did the mediator say? She told us to work it out. Work what out? She told us to figure out what boundaries we want in our relationship. Diane and Dan exchanged troubled glances. Of course, nothing would be simple in California. Was that okay with you? Dan probed. Diane was relieved at Diane's concern. Maybe he could take over as the moral compass for the family's difficult journey through their son's adolescence. Dan was making his serious trouble face, the oddly crunched-up eyes and pursed lips of concentration. Sure, Jeremy shrugged. So what did you decide with her? Diane asked. We decided not to talk for a while. Is that all right with you? Sure. Later that evening, she asked Alex for more details. I don't hear everything, Mom. That part was private. Tucking Jeremy in, she asked later that evening, Are you satisfied with how it turned out, honey? Because if... How would she finish that sentence, she wondered, staring at her son's pajamaed back, his fragile neck. Sure, he replied sleepily. It's fine. Do you think you'll ever want to talk to her again? Ever? Maybe when I'm older. Diane went outside and stood on her deck that she still preferred to call a porch, though porches didn't exist here. The deck, like all of their structure, was in need of repair. Seen by day, their whole house looked as if it might be swallowed up by its environment, if they ignored it much longer. Some windows lacked sills. Here and there, shingles hung loosely. The roof was rotting near a dining room skylight. When it rained hard, they put buckets on the rug. She imagined the place returning to pulp, trees concealing its former existence from the world, as if it were a plane lost in the jungle. Her realtor had put it right when they'd bought the place. Better to have the worst house in the neighborhood than the best one in a bad neighborhood. Better to have the worst house in a good neighborhood than the best one in a bad neighborhood. Sorry. Diane looked away from the place and up into the sky. Clearer on this side of the Mississippi, she'd read once. She tried to find some familiar stars. But so many things were moving overhead. Clouds and airplanes she could see, and telecommunication satellites she couldn't, that she got distracted. Somewhere in space, some Russians and Americans were trying to get a telescope to work properly. A $1 billion repair, the paper had announced, was taking place right over her head. So much up there had no meaning to the casual gazer. And besides, the skies weren't needed for charting the stars anymore. At her own university, a perfectly looking ordinary fellow, younger than Diane herself, was finding new planets to conceive of. Finding new planets and now even a solar system, without the usual props. Computers and formulae, methods Diane couldn't begin to conceive of, had been invented while she was doing what? Having children and trying to raise them? Moving to a ridiculous new location? Star charts were of limited use. There were new methods for everything. No wonder people wanted to seal things off before their own eyes calculated all the possible terrors of the moment. Maybe that's why their new life seemed so what? So full of misgivings? But she knew that wasn't what she wanted to call it, that the word she wanted needed that the word she wanted needed to hold so much, it couldn't possibly bear the pressure. Maybe there would be new words soon to describe these feelings. Maybe her boys would be alive when all the old fears turned into knowledge. Maybe Dan would know what to call their new lives already. He was so good with words. Or that soulful detective she'd seen on TV, eager to give death a new name. Maybe he'd come up with something she'd hear about soon on the news. Thank you.